One of the nice things about that little screen is, of course, you can see who's coming in. Yeah. It's just for being festive. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 1. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice of one calling, in the desert prepare the way for the Lord. Make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed. And all mankind together will see it, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. A voice says, cry out. And I say, what shall I cry? All men are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, the flowers fall, because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God stands forever. You who bring good tidings to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You who bring good tidings to Jerusalem, lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up, do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and his arm rules for him. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? If you like the song that we learned sort of at the very end of last year or this year, you know, who, that one. This is where it's from, you recognize it. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? Or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? Who has understood the mind of the Lord? Or instructed him as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Before him all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? Well, just very briefly, so that we can understand our connection with this passage a little more clearly, let's just think of the setting and the scope of the passage. That is, where is it set in history in Isaiah, and where does it reach to? Is it just sort of stuck back there, or does it have a far wider scope? And of course, the answer is that it does. From Isaiah 40 on, the attention of the prophecies of the oracles is focused on the children of Israel, particularly the people of Judah, in exile. So carted off en masse by Nebuchadnezzar after Jerusalem fell, and 586 BC, and but under siege, and in fact under foreign rule, long before the city of Jerusalem fell. You may remember that Ezekiel is prophesying to exiles about Jerusalem, and during the run of Ezekiel's 52 prophecies, Jerusalem falls. So we've already got people in exile, and Jerusalem still occupied and held before it actually is totally breached and suffers such destruction. So these prophecies are focused on the exiles. They are given to them almost entirely to make sense of two things, a bit like Ezekiel. First of all, why they are there, and secondly, why they're not going to be there forever. Why they are there? Because of their sins. Why are they not going to be there forever? Because God will forgive their sins and bring them back, as he promised. And both the exile and the return, of course, are spoken about by God towards the end of Deuteronomy, in that crucial section, 28 to 32 of Deuteronomy. Crucial for understanding what the prophets kept talking about, and what the exiles were about when they came for the northern 10 tribes and for the southern tribe of Judah. So Isaiah is speaking to people who are broken. They are humiliated. They have lost their homes, their livelihoods. They have lost their dignity. They have settled, but they are still foreigners, aliens, and marginalized. So they're very vulnerable. They're away from home, they're broken, and they have a huge spiritual problem. And the problem is, where is God, and what does he think of us now? Has he cast us off forever? Is there a God? And so all those doubts are assailing them. But they also need to come to terms with the fact that they are rebels, not victims, that they are there because of their sin. And whilst they have the theological questions about God, there is also this huge thing that the prophets address, which is their sort of personal problem, the heart problem, of realizing that they are there, not because God has abandoned them, but because of their sin. Not because God is failing in his word, but because God is keeping his word entirely. So, these people, broken, away from home, rebels, not victims, having to come to terms with their sin, are given messages that make that clear, but constantly being given messages of hope. Constantly being given things to look forward to that God is going to do. And what he's going to do is not simply bring them back to the land, but he's going to change their hearts. He's going to make them new. And the way in which coming back to Judah, to Jerusalem, is spoken about is where we begin to see the scope of the prophecies. Because nearly all of them, in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, elsewhere in the Old Testament, in major and minor prophets, the return from exile, this sort of reconciling and rehabilitating work of God, is always spoken of in ways that go way beyond that particular return. That is, they don't make sense if we just read them as applying to the there and then return from exile. More is being done than historically happened. More is being done as God brings his people back than was undone when they were sent away. More is being restored to them than they ever lost. And the breadth and scale of God's work extends in so many of the prophecies beyond what he's going to do for them. So we keep reading all through that the nations are involved in all this. And something is going to happen to the nations. And the nations will begin to turn to God and seek God. And it's in these return prophecies of the exilic prophets that we begin to see this thing about the day of the Lord emerging. So there is a historical there and then application. But there's way more than that. And the more than that is where you and I come in. Because the more than that includes and really speaks of Christ and what he will do. So the return isn't just a there and then historical return from exile to resettle and reoccupy the land and Jerusalem, rebuild Jerusalem. The return is a returning to God spiritually. So as we said before, it's not just you don't just get your postcode changed, you get your heart changed. And a return to God of the nations that were scattered during the judgment that followed Babel, the Gentiles. So the scope of this prophecy goes way beyond the immediate historical context, way beyond its historical setting. And it speaks of you and me as well, because it speaks of what God, as we see looking back, accomplished through Christ. So what is God like? God became this baby, we're saying. What is God like? What was this baby all about? Why did the Magi worship him? Why did the angels sing of the one whom God has sent from heaven? Why did Micah prophesy about one who will come from you, but who is from you, but is also from me, whose origins are from old? So here is how Isaiah in this part speaks to the people about the wonder and greatness of the baby, as we know he became in Bethlehem. So first of all, our God is the God who comforts sinners. Now, that's very interesting, isn't it? Because quite clearly, as we read verses 1 and 2, we get the picture of a people who do not deserve to be comforted. When we read the phrase, God comforts sinners, there's something in that. If we read it with sort of the non-Christian world around us in mind, that phrase will get heard as something that, well, God ought to do. You know, that God ought to be there to comfort sinners, that we ought to be able to somehow or another, we should expect that God will comfort us. But the whole point about the sinners is that they are rebels, not victims. That they aren't victims who need comforting. And that what we deserve is not comfort, but judgment. What we deserve is not to be spoken tenderly to, but in actual fact, we're spoken to with God's wrath. And it's very clear that God comforts sinners there, because when God says, speak tenderly to Jerusalem, it's not out of sympathy, it's not out of mere pity, it's not saying there, everything's going to be all right in some sort of cosseting sort of way, as if there wasn't a real problem. It's to those who have sinned. And sinned repeatedly and sinned a lot, and it's been a people's sin, not just individuals who have done naughty things. Very interesting at the moment, isn't it? Over the last couple of days and all in the news again today, the questions over the police, the Hillsborough thing, the new police inquiry is going to be launched, it was announced today, plebgate incident. You know, now the questions, if you happen to listen to Radio 4, certainly anyway, probably less so on Radios 1 and 2 at the moment. But the questions are, can we trust the police? And the answer that keeps coming back is, well, of course, as a general, in the whole, terrific, but there are, you know, a few bad apples in the barrel. And that's one of our classic ways of saying it's wrong to judge and we should all expect judgment, you know, all expect comfort. You know, sure, there are a few bad apples in the barrel, but basically we're all okay. As an institution, human beings are all right. But when God speaks to his people and has Isaiah comfort them, comfort, comfort my people, says the God. The repetition is the Hebrew way of intensifying something. Proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed. Speak tenderly to them. Tell her that her sins have been paid double for, more than covered over, all her sins. What we're talking about is a people who for centuries worshipped other gods, for centuries turned their back on Jehovah, who institutionalized idolatry. A people who, however good or bad life was for them, thanked or appealed to anybody or anything except the God who was doing everything for them. So here are people whose religion had become offensive to God. If we were to read the earlier chapters of Isaiah, we would see a quite unremitting catalogue of sin, the big middle section of the early part of Isaiah is grim reading. At some point next term, we'll be doing a study of Isaiah, and on Wednesday evenings, and take a sort of hop, skip, and a jump through the book, and we'll see that. But God comes to sinners and says, your sin has been paid for. Now you've paid double. You've no more fear to have before God. You've no more wrath to face, no more judgment to come. Now, of course, the people were going to sin again. But the payment has been made. The ransom has been paid. The cup of God's wrath that he's bringing around them has been poured out. And so now, as God speaks in truth to sinners, he speaks tenderly. That his tenderness is not a sort of a there, your sin doesn't really matter. He can speak tenderly to sinners because the sin has been paid for. Because the judgment has been handed out. Because they've received from the Lord's hand double for all their sins. How? See, it doesn't fit just there and then. It requires something bigger than a return from exile to fit. And so God can truly speak comfort to us and to you. And this little baby in Bethlehem spells out comfort for sinners without ever reducing the sinfulness of the sin. This little baby says there is comfort coming for sinners. There is a payment going to be made. There is going to be all the wrath poured out from God's hand that sin could ever deserve. And then it goes on. The God who comes to get us, verses 3 to 5. A voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way for the Lord, make straight. What's going on there? For yonks, I used to read this as if this was God sort of making his way to Jerusalem kind of thing. But of course, that's because I was stupid. We just remember the geography of it. God is having Isaiah speak in Jerusalem to people who, in days to come, will be out of Jerusalem, right? And the geography of it is that God is in Jerusalem. The people are way out there across the desert in exile. What's it describing then? It's describing God going on this way that has been prepared, this highway through the wilderness for him to go and get his people. So he's paid the price for their sin. Their hard service has been completed. Her sin is forgiven. But they still cannot get themselves back to him. It needs him to go and get them. And what Isaiah is hearing, this voice telling him to cry out, a voice of one calling, in the desert prepare the way for the Lord, is let's get all creation and everything making a way for God to come and get us. So God leaves the place where he has made his name to dwell, Jerusalem, his temple. God leaves heaven on earth and goes to the place of brokenness, of alienation, where rebels end up, to get them and bring them home. So in verses 3 through 5, what you have is this astonishing description of God leaving his home and coming to the place where sinners dwell in judgment, under judgment, and bringing them back. So he not only forgives their sin, but he restores them to where they should be. And he makes his home, the place where he has made his name to dwell, once again, their home. So immediately we're thinking, I know where that was fulfilled. I know who spoke about that. This is Jesus saying, I go to prepare a place for you in my Father's house, where there are many mansions. And if I go and prepare a place to you, I will come again and receive you to myself so that you might be where I am. Well, this is the kind of thing which, as Jesus speaks about there of his second coming, we might see also being given another echo in his first coming, in the baby, in his actual birth there, that he left all the glory of heaven. This is Philippians 2, 6 through 11 thing, isn't it? Where he emptied himself of all that and became a man. Well, first of all, a baby. Because it goes in that order. Baby first, then man. So here is God coming to get us. Why was that? Well, you see, whilst the people of Israel, first of all, were absolutely gutted at being exiled and expressed that in some of their sort of exilic lament psalms, you know, there we hung up our harps, they settled. They ran all the danger of the northern tribes who had been carted off to Samaria, of going native. And God had said to them through Jeremiah, look, when you get there, pray for the peace and prosperity of the city you're in. Sit, you know, marry your daughters and sons. Build your houses, plant your crops and everything else. But the intention of that was, whilst you're there, prosper, because you're going home. But whilst you're there, don't dwindle and die, because you're going home. But they went native. So God had to go and get them. And it is the case with you and me. So God comes to us. God takes initiative with us in the incarnation at the second coming. We know the danger, don't we, of going native. We know the danger of forgetting that this place is not our home. Just as when before we were in Christ, we were completely gone native. We were the rebels. God comes to get us. And then the third thing about this baby and all the glory of God wrapped in this little flesh is that he's the God whose word endures forever. Verses 6, 7 and 8. What's it saying there? Well, it's the last little phrase that is the key to it. The word of our God stands forever. And the first part of that last clause is the word but. So what we have up until then is everything passing away. All men are like grass and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. So people come and make grand promises. People come and say everything's going to be all right. False prophets have said peace, peace, when there's not going to be any peace. There have been attempts at treaties and alliances and all that. Nah, it just all fades away. All goes. There have been kings. Well, they came and they went. They died. All men are like grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God stands forever. As if to say, God really will comfort sinners. God really will come and get you. And he said he will. And nobody is Lord over him whose breath might blow on him. Verse 7. So it'll happen. Nobody can delete his word. And nobody can put him off fulfilling his promises. Nobody can prevent him. He's never going to forget. He's not going to change his mind and suddenly go off you. Has he said he'll comfort sinners? Has he said he'll come and get you? Well, he will. Let's just pause there and take the word to heart. Our guilty consciences, when we sin, our guilty consciences can do more work than the conscience was ever meant to do. That is to say, God gives us a conscience to turn us back to himself. The Spirit pricks the conscience. The Spirit stabs it. The Spirit nudges, needles our consciences and leads us to God to seek his forgiveness. But our consciences can do more than they were ever intended to do. Our consciences can, having been stabbed and pricked and nudged, then keep us from enjoying the forgiveness of God. So we sin in some particular way that dogs us, and we sort of give ourselves a kind of self-imposed half an hour of misery before we ever feel we might have a blessing again. Our consciences go into overdrive, stirred by the accuser, not by the Spirit. And we don't enjoy forgiveness. We don't rejoice in forgiveness. Or maybe we fear that if we totally rejoice in the comfort and tenderness and mercy of God, somehow that will make us soft on sin. Well, God really comforts sinners. And if your conscience is laboring over something, if there's something that you just keeps dogging your conscience and you feel weighed down by, and it may be something from earlier today, maybe something from earlier on in your life altogether, God says the hard service has been completed. Sin has been paid for. The Lord's hand has dished out double for all your sin. The wrath has been dispensed. And from the Father is comfort and tenderness. Luxuriate, bathe, rest in the complete and total forgiveness of God. A forgiveness that requires no debt to be paid. A forgiveness that does not come with strings attached. Which is what so much of our forgiveness comes with, isn't it? A forgiveness that does not make us squirm first. Remember how the prodigal's father did not say, "I told you so," but welcomed him back so fully. So enjoy the forgiveness of God. It's way better than the forgiveness even of many Christians, which can be pretty slow and pretty conditional sometimes. And sometimes withheld with self-righteousness. And he is the God who comes to get us. He has done. And he will do. Do you doubt that you'd be in heaven? Do you think sometimes, "Oh, I've blown it now"? Well, he's going to come and get you. It's Jesus' prayer, "I have prayed that they might be where I am." John 17. It's Jesus who said that, "I'll come again and take you to myself so that you can be in the place that I've prepared for you." There's a seat in heaven and it's got your name on it if you're in Christ. Nobody else can sit there. It's not going to be empty for all eternity with, you know, other people and angels and God saying, "Oh, I wish they'd got here. I really regret it." You'll be there. Because God's word endures forever. And so Isaiah then, as God is giving him these oracles, says, "Here is your God, that you who bring good tidings to Zion, go up on a high mountain, you who bring good tidings to Jerusalem, lift up your voice." That is, everything that God is good news for you. Because he's the one who forgives you and gives comfort for sinners, because he's the one who comes to get you, because his word endures forever, everything about your God that you want to know is good news for you. And has to be shouted and proclaimed. It's good tidings. Tell it out. Here is your God. Well, what is he like then? First of all, he is a king. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power and his arm rules for him. See, his reward is with him and his recompense accompanies him. That is to say, nobody can put him off his saving purposes. He is sovereign. Jehovah. His arm rules for him. So rest in the power of God to save. Second verse 11, he is the shepherd, which is of course another kingly, sovereign picture, but it tells us what kind of king he is. He's a king who tends his flock, who gathers a lamb in his arms, carries them close to his heart, gently leads those that are young. You are close to God's heart. He is carrying you. He's carried you today. He's carried you through today. Here is the king going to get his people and bring them back home like a shepherd bringing lambs in, picking them up because they're weak and tired and don't know the way. And he holds them close to his heart because they mean so much to him. And he's keeping them at a distance. He holds them close to his heart to carry them home. So your father has carried you today. How has he carried you? Reluctantly? No, he's carried you close to his heart because you mean so much to him. He is the awesome creator who has measured the hollow in the waters in the hollows of his hand. He is in charge of everything. He knows everything. He knows how to do everything. He understands everything. Nothing's going to catch him out. Nothing's going to overpower him. No enemy's too clever and going to wrong foot him. So as the awesomeness of the Creator is brought to our attention in 12 through 14, it is to reassure us of his capacity to save us. And then, again, the scope expands to include us. He's the God of all the nations. Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They're regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires. Lebanon, that is synonymous with cedars and trees and forests. Nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Now, we just have to sort of remember what's going on here in the Hebrew. Before him all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. Now, worthless doesn't mean that they aren't, you know, he couldn't care less about them in that sense. If you used to measure the worth of something by, or particularly of a person, some potentate or high up, high hegemon, by the great big scales, and in these days, and so they sat on one side, and you started heaping gold or jewels, everything, on the other side, and when all the weight of gold balanced the weight of the person, right, that's what they were worth. That's why the Hebrew for glory is kavod, which means to be heavy, right? So, yeah, it paid to be a fat king. You know, you'd sit in the scales, and all your subjects would bing, come along and pile all the gold. And once they got you balanced in the scales, that was yours. And they'd shown literally how much you were worth to them, or more likely, how much their own heads were worth to them. So it paid to eat a lot. Which is why archaeologists still keep digging up McDonald's, Burger King, Greggs, all that kind of stuff. They don't. Now, that's the sense of worthless. It goes with the a drop in a bucket, regarded as dust on the scales. So you see what's going on there. All the nations are such fine dust that if you put them on that side, you wouldn't need to put, you'd have to put a halfpenny on that side. That's what it's saying. It's not that they don't mean anything to God, because he's going to save them. It's saying the nations which have been your threat are no threat to him. The nations whom you have feared, the nations who have trampled all over your land, the nations who have casted you off into exile, the nations who have slaughtered your children, are no problem for God. He is the God over all the nations. And the nations will serve him. The nations will worship him too. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. So he's the God of all the nations. That is, verse 18, he is incomparable. The incomparable God. And it makes the idea of comparing him to an image just seem ludicrous then, doesn't it? All this laid in a manger. Our God contracted to a span, incomprehensibly made man. All this in the manger. And it is such a help to us to remember that all that we're preaching about and singing about and inviting people along to hear about, all that we try and express when we write Christmas cards and stick in just some phrase that points to Christ or whatever, all that we want for our colleagues and our friends and our neighbours and members of our families, all that we want them to grasp about Christmas is not just some points about Jesus that they've forgotten. It's not just we want them to remember the reason for the season. We don't just want them to remember that it's all about Jesus, not about children. It's all about a boy, not any old child. Actually, what we want them to know is how wonderful God is. We want them to know how glorious God's goodness is. We want them to know the height, breadth, depth and length of the love of God. We want them to see this love that surpasses knowledge. We want them to see this grace upon grace, blessing upon blessing that has come with Jesus Christ. We want them to see that for them there is comfort, true comfort from God. We want them to know that God has come to get them because he loves them. We want them to know that his promises are true and you can build your life on them. We want them to see the wonder and glory of God, to worship him. We want them to behold their God. That's what we want them to see. We're not just sort of going on a warfare against tinsel and baubles. We want people to know the unknowable love of God, the immeasurable love of God. God became this baby. And it's not just a theological point to make in a biblically literate culture. It is gospel. And it has questions attached to it. And you may have noticed that the first question is different. So for those of you who are change averse, And you may notice also that question three invites you to write a Christmas carol. And if you think that you can't do that, that's okay. But you might be wrong. You might be able to make a group effort. And possibly a carol that's been written by a committee might be just like a camel that was a horse designed by a committee. But I want also to look at number four. Where does the plane land in your own heart tonight? Let it not be simply a word that gives us something to say to the world. But let it be a word which speaks to our own hearts also. So I shall leave you with the questions. And I think there's three groups in tonight's company. I think two groups that would be too large. I think you need three, maybe even four groups. But I leave that to you to organise. And if you get yourselves opposite corners of the room whilst I'm upstairs and I hear someone saying, bring me a, then I'll know you've finished the questions and you're on to the party games. Okay.